Thanks for listening to the Nice Podcast. I'm Dave Delaney. If you haven't noticed, we've taken a little bit of a hiatus over the last several months. A big revelation was found. I have ADHD, and that explains a whole lot. And of course, naturally, as a veteran podcaster, I started another podcast all about it. And it's called ADHD Wise Squirrels. And you can find it at wisesquirrels.com or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just search ADHD Wise Squirrels. Pop over and have a listen. Let me know what you think. Thanks.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcasts.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Passion is infectious. And when people are exposed to other people's passions, even if they don't share those passions, that passion is infectious. So I don't have to love the Boston Red Sox, but I can appreciate the people who are passionate fans of the Boston Red Sox.
Nice.
With Dave Delaney.
Welcome to the Nice Podcast, all about communication, collaboration, and becoming better leaders. I'm your host, Dave Delaney from FutureForth.com, where we help fast-growing tech companies retain talent and improve culture so you have happier, more connected teams. Today, I'm speaking with David Meerman Scott, the author of 12 amazing books, including New Rules of Marketing and PR. It's kind of the one of the Bibles for marketers, and the Wall Street Journal bestselling book that I'm excited to talk to you about, Fanocracy. He's a marketing and business growth strategist, an entrepreneur, and advisor to emerging companies. David, welcome to Nice.
Thanks, Dave. So good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks. I've been looking forward to chatting with you. I always like to start these shows off with the question, what is the nicest thing someone has done for you recently?
The nicest thing someone has done for me recently. So, as you may know, I'm a huge fan of the Grateful Dead. I've seen 83 concerts, and I'm just a huge fan of it. And I wrote a book called Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead with my buddy Brian Halligan. Brian is the co-founder and executive chairman of HubSpot. And Brian happens to own Jerry Garcia's Wolf Guitar, is worth many millions of dollars. It's perhaps the most valuable guitar in the world. And this week I had a chance to bring the guitar up to a show in Vermont. And it was just super nice to be able to curate this amazing instrument for a couple of days and allow the musicians to play it both at the show itself as well as the next day. One of the musicians played it on their studio album that they were recording. Mm-hmm. And it's also awesome for the fans. So it was nice for me, but it was also nice that Brian lent this guitar for the musicians to be able to play and lent this guitar for the fans to be able to appreciate. I think it's just super nice. It's not just a guitar that's sitting on the wall in a man cave. It's a guitar that everyone can experience.
Yeah, and I think that is an incredible gesture. And you did something similar, right, with the Modulus Black Knife. Is that correct?
Yeah, good memory. So I have Bob Weir guitars. Was used in about 100 shows in the mid-1980s. And I actually brought that guitar with me as well up to this show. So they're playing two Grateful Dead instruments at this. And it's a band that plays Grateful Dead music, of course. In a small way, I do it myself. But the guitar I own is nowhere near as well known and iconic as Jerry Garcia's guitar. But the theme of Nice, Brian and I, and there's about three or four other people who are very different kinds of, we're both collectors, although I only have one guitar and Brian only has one guitar that's a historic instrument. Mm. But we're a very different type of owner than the typical owner that just has it up on the wall. because we feel like we're curating it for the rest of the world to be able to appreciate as well. And so, yes, my guitar has been to a number of shows that people have played it, but it's nowhere near as iconic as Jerry Garcia's Wolf.
Yeah, but that's pretty amazing too. I mean, such a cool, I mean, when I first heard about that, I thought that is such a neat and cool idea for, you know, Dead fans and cover bands and so on who might have an opportunity to touch the guitar, pose for a photo with a guitar, let alone actually play it, for a song or two.
Right. Well,
play
it for a song. There are 350 people at the club who are there.
Yeah.
You know, in the presence of the instrument that has Jerry Garcia's juju. Jerry Garcia played it for about 10 years and in many, many hundreds of concerts. And interestingly, this idea goes back quite a few years because for a long time in the classical music world, this has been an accepted way to get instruments into the hands of excellent players. You know, the people who own a Stradivarius violin are typically not the best players who use a Stradivarius in their concerts. Mm. Typically, it's somebody who owns it as an investment, and then they lend it out to the players so that they can play it in their concerts. But until very recently, until Brian and I started to loan our instruments out, it had never been used in the rock and roll. This idea had never been used in the rock and roll world. Hmm. People would buy famous instruments, typically at auction, but then they would just go into somebody's man cave for a while, or they would go on the wall of a Hard Rock Cafe somewhere, or they would go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, all of which are good, but being able to be out and played and enjoyed is just, you know, your word, nice. It's just nice.
It really is. So I guess it hasn't earned its sticker, which reads no fun.
It is fun, man. It is fun to do. Yeah. So the story behind my guitar, No Fun, is Bobby Weir was playing it. He first played it October 23rd, 1983 at Madison Square Garden. I happened to be at that show. And about a year later, one of their roadies put this a sticker that has the word fun, F-U-N, with the universal symbol for no. And so now this instrument is known to deadheads as the No Fun guitar. And it's so it's so ironic that it's so much fun to play the guitar and the musicians love playing it. But it's called the No Fun guitar. And it's the only guitar that Bob Weir has owned that has a name. Most of Jerry's guitars had names. Mm. There was No Fun with Bobby, but Jerry had Wolf, he had Tiger, he had Rosebud. He typically named his guitars, whereas Bobby Weir only had one that I know of that had a name.
That's super cool. And so you and Reiko wrote or co-wrote Phenocracy.
Yes.
And a key point in Phenocracy, I think, is about, you know, about becoming not necessarily the ringleader per se, but connecting like-minded people and then building that Phenocracy. And in my own, you know, experiences and writing about networking over the years and speaking on the topic, you know, big points of that I've always hit on is like talking to strangers and getting out there and then being generous. And I find this kind of full circle on what we're talking about here with the Grateful Dead's, with your love of the Grateful Dead and these instruments and kind of the goodness you're putting out in the world with Brian. You know, when you connected with Brian, you know, HubSpot was in its infancy, but you were getting out there and you guys started talking. So you were talking to strangers. You somehow landed on the Grateful Dead being, you know, the thing that you guys are totally connected on that and living in Japan. And you were generous enough to offer him a ticket. So that conversation might have been dead in the water after that. Like, hey, it was great, but you offered him a ticket.
It was a really, really interesting experience, and it changed my life quite literally because the new rules of marketing and PR had just come out. This is 2007. That was the first edition of the book. I'm now have finished the eighth edition, which will be coming out in mid-2022. Mm. But the first edition came out, this is 15 years ago, and they had just started HubSpot in 2006. And HubSpot didn't have any clients yet. They had just beta software, only 8 employees. And they reached out to me and said, "Hey, David, these ideas in your book are the same ideas that we started our company around, and we'd love to have you come in for a discussion." I said, that sounds like fun. I should do that. So it was very close to meet my house, only about 10 miles away. So I went into Cambridge and I opened up my notebook computer, and on a sticker on my notebook computer was a Grateful Dead logo. Yeah. And so immediately I tagged myself as a member of the tribe. And Reiko and I co-wrote our book, Fanocracy. Reiko, my daughter, she's now 28 years old. Hmm. And one of the things that we discovered is that the way to build fans is to create a tribe of like-minded people. And the Grateful Dead did that in a huge way. You know, we are a tribe of like-minded people. And once Brian identified me as a Grateful Dead fan, and he was able, "Oh my God, I'm a huge fan too. Look at that sticker on the back of your computer." And we started geeking out about the Grateful Dead. And meanwhile, his colleagues were like kind of rolling their thumbs, like, "What's going on here?" And then, as you said, I had a spare ticket for a show that was coming up in a couple of weeks. I said, "Hey, let's go to the show together." He's like, "Great, I'm in." And then within about 2 weeks, Brian invited me to join his advisory board as the first member of the HubSpot advisory board. It's 15 years later, I'm still on the advisory board. Mm. So what does that tell us? I think it's super interesting that the idea of simply sharing what you're a fan of, in my case, this is just a Grateful Dead sticker on the back of my computer, sharing what you're a fan of shows what you're passionate about.
Yeah.
And this idea of passion is something that very few people mix their business life and their personal life. You know, they have their LinkedIn, which is their business, and, you know, they don't talk about anything of a personal nature on their LinkedIn. And then they have their Facebook for their personal stuff, but they don't do any business stuff on their Facebook. That's what most people do, especially in B2B. Mm. But what I learned when my daughter and I studied this idea of fandom, one of the most surprising things is how important passion is. Passion is infectious. And when people are exposed to other people's passions, even if they don't share those passions, that passion is infectious. So I don't have to love the Boston Red Sox, but I can appreciate the people who are passionate fans of the Boston Red Sox. And this idea of sharing what you're passionate about in your business life is something that's really interesting. I'll give you an example in my daughter's world. So when we were writing the book, she was finishing up her undergraduate degree, which she did at Columbia University in neuroscience. And then she started going to medical school, which she's now graduated from. Mm. And she's now an emergency room doctor at Boston Medical Center.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, as we're making this recording, it's tough at BMC. You know, lots of people come in with COVID, and the doctors, like my daughter, have to be protected head to toe with personal protective equipment, PPE, and they've got, you know, mask and a hairnet and gloves and you know, basically everything but their eyes are covered. Mm. They look like an alien when they're coming in to talk to a patient. Now, can you imagine? You're scared. You've got a health condition. Perhaps it's COVID, perhaps it's something else, but oh my God, I'm in the hospital and I'm frightened. And then this alien doctor comes in. You can only see their eyes. That's scary. So what Reiko does and what some of the other doctors do is they have as part of their uniform the things that they love. So Reiko started by just putting a pin or several different pins on her, I don't know what you call it in the doctor world, shirt, but that's not the right word.
Right.
And so she would wear sometimes a Black Lives Matter pin or a rainbow pin, for example. And then she started to wear a mask that had one of the Boston sports teams on it. She happens to be a big Boston Bruins fan. Mm. And then Boston Medical Center found that this was working really well with patients because now they had a reason to relate to the doctor. It's not just an alien coming in. You can only see their eyes. Here's a Red Sox fan or a Boston Bruins fan coming in.
Yeah.
So they actually created Team BMC sweatshirts. that they can wear over the rest of their doctor uniform. Mm-hmm. And the Team BMC sweatshirts are in the logos of the Boston sports team. So they can wear a Team BMC sweatshirt that has a Boston Bruins logo or a Boston Red Sox logo on it. And the patients come alive, and it immediately breaks down the fear. Because all of a sudden, you're not dealing with an alien doctor. All of a sudden, you're dealing with a human who loves a sports team. And it doesn't even matter if you're not a fan of the same sports team. You've humanized yourself. And, you know, I think in the B2B world, it's especially true that we very rarely humanize ourselves. And one of the most simple ways to do that is just simply to share the things that you love, because what you love, your passions are infectious, and people don't need to share it. People don't need to share the fact that I love the Grateful Dead. They don't need to share that, but they can appreciate that I do. And that's important.
It absolutely is. In the book, she wrote about, in one of her sections, she wrote about meeting one of her professors and about a similar story of you know, meeting a like-minded person, in their case, sharing a love and a passion for poetry. And in the book, she wrote, learning how to incorporate all of who I am into my professional life made me not only a better health provider, but also a happier person. And so with that point, how do you recommend, a B2B type of professional be able to incorporate more of their passions into their profession?
Yeah, and that was a really cool story that Reiko shared.
Yeah, it was.
When she was an undergraduate at Columbia, and she was going on an interview for the possibility to work as an intern in a lab. And this was a, you know, big, important doctor that she was applying for. And you know, she was young. She was probably, 19 or 20, and never really gone on these big interviews before. And she walked in, and the shelves of this doctor's office were filled with books, and particularly filled with poetry books. And they ended up spending half an hour talking about poetry.
Yeah.
Right? They weren't talking about, you know, doctor stuff or healthcare stuff. They were talking about poetry. And so that was when she realized, and it was a big moment for her, that was when she realized that she can share the things that she loves in her professional life. And so I think that it's just simply a matter of giving yourself permission to break down the barriers between your personal life and your professional life. People want to do business with people. They don't want to do business in the B2B world. You know, we focus on, oh, we're going to sell to, I don't know, General Electric. We're going to sell to United Airlines. We're going to sell to Fidelity Investments. You think my customer is United Airlines or Fidelity Investments or IBM. No, your customers are people that work in those organizations. And so sometimes we forget that. And the idea of humanizing yourself, the idea of creating ways that you can break down the artificial barriers and have a true connection with other human beings. And the way to do that is just simply to be thinking about what I can share. So it can be as simple as in your LinkedIn profile, it doesn't have to be at the top, but in your LinkedIn profile, when you've got your bio, say, I think I've got it on mine. David Mirren Scott has been to 83 Grateful Dead concerts.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that have to do with my work? Well, I guess I've written a book about the Grateful Dead, Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead. So maybe it has a little bit to do with it, but it really doesn't have much to do with my work.
I think you were at a few of those shows before the book was conceived.
Quite a few. Very few people do that, Dave. Yeah. Very few people do that. Create some posts. So, whatever it is you love, Peloton, a sports team, a rock band, in my case, is one of my passions. I also love to surf. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll put something up on my social networks about surfing. Perhaps you're into bird watching, or perhaps you're into skiing, or, whatever it is that you're into, share that on your business social media pages. Share that on your bio on the company website. That's important stuff. It really is truly important to be able to share with people what you're passionate about.
One passion that we share a few, but one passion that I believe we share is a passion for travel. You lived in Asia for nearly 10 years, and was it in Toyooka where you met Yukari, your wife? And excuse me for butchering the name there.
That's okay. Yeah, you actually got it right. It's Yukari.
Okay.
So I moved to Tokyo when I was 26. Mm. And I moved to open the Asian office of a Wall Street economic consulting firm. And so I was doing B2B marketing and sales all by myself. I didn't know a single person when I landed in Tokyo. Hmm. And I created a branch office of the company. It was super interesting. And yes, that's where I met my wife. And we lived in Tokyo for 7 years. We got married. And then we moved to Hong Kong for a couple of years. Reiko is our daughter. She's obviously mixed race, Japanese and American. But yeah, I love to travel. And I'm a geek. I'm a geek when it comes to, and that's why I was able to tell you that I went to 83 Grateful Dead concerts, and I've been to 832 concerts of all different bands. And I've been to 107 countries, all 50 states, and all 7 continents. And I know that because I have a spreadsheet that I list them. But yeah, I do love travel. So what are your favorite places to travel to?
Well, Ireland is a natural because as a Canadian, I went to Ireland in 96, but then I went back in 98 and met my wife there who's from Tennessee, which is how I live in Nashville now. So we lived in Toronto for 7 years, had 2 kids. We still have them, although they're 15 and 16 right now. So
they're in that active stage of wanting to break away. I get it.
Is that what they call it? Active.
Yeah. Active
stage. I can think of other words.
They end up coming back, at least in my experience. They need to show their independence, and then after a certain couple of years, they'll come back.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I hear good things about the, they're actually Irish twins of all. So it's kind of funny that way. We always joke that we should have seen it coming. A quote that I love about travel is, "The world is a book, and those who do not travel read only one page." And it was St. Augustine.
That's super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, like one of our, my wife and I, Heather, you know, one of our family mottos is experiences over things. And over the holidays. Over the holidays, we took the kids to France and Belgium and Luxembourg for a minute, and then down to Switzerland to see my brother who lives in Bern. And our kids have been to Iceland. They've been to other countries, and they have friends who've never left Tennessee, let alone the U.S.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that, and how can we inspire others? And I know we're a little off topic here as far as leadership and things perhaps, but I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
I think this is a super important question, because I learned so much by living outside the United States for nearly 10 years. And I'm not suggesting that everybody can live outside their country, but certainly they can visit, because I learned to see my country from the perspective of an outsider. Mm. And I think that when you're open to an experience in another country, what you're realizing is that we're actually, all humans are more alike than we are different. Mm. And, I'm going to riff a little bit. I think that the Facebook algorithm is the most destructive technology ever invented. Mm-hmm. I really believe that what the Facebook algorithm does is it drives people into polarizing groups, because Facebook is optimized to get people to want to stay on the platform longer. And what they realized is that when you're angry, you stay on the site longer than when you're not angry. So they get people riled up and angry. And they get people to believe in conspiracy theories and to pit one type of person against another, mm-hmm. whether it's one country against another or whatever it might be. And so I believe that's very destructive from the perspective of Facebook. But I believe also that the more you can experience in your own world this idea that, no, these people really aren't that different, whether it's in my country, the red states versus the blue states. People who don't travel in the United States tend to have a feeling that, oh, I live in wherever it might be, a red state or a blue state, and those other states that are the other color are bad. Mm. Well, no, they're not. They just have a different outlook. And if you have a chance to travel and meet people who live in those other states, who maybe have a different political persuasion, that you can learn to understand and accept that rather than just focus on the idea of what Facebook is doing is pushing you into these very polarizing tribes. So, yeah, I think you've hit on something that's really, really important, not just traveling internationally, but also even just traveling, and certainly within my country where we are, I think, at the most polarized we've ever been in our 200 and however many year history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting from my own, like I've lived in the States now for 15 years and have seen much of the country before that and certainly over the last 15 years. And it is, yeah, it is a troubling sort of period right now where maybe we'll talk a little bit about that polarization with social media, because, you know, like yourself, I mean, I've been a big proponent of social media, since the infancy of social networks and, you know, BBSing before that, but I'm not getting a little nerdy there.
You're dating yourself.
I actually bought a Commodore 64 a few years ago.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's, there's a wireless adapter you can get for a Commodore 64 that attaches to the internet now. So you can actually, you can call BBSs again. They actually still exist.
Oh, you know what? I bought an iPhone 13. I bought an iPhone 13 when it first came out.
Yeah.
And I was chit-chatting with the salesperson at Apple. And I said, you know, I've still got my iPhone 1. And he goes, oh, really? You should check and see if you've got the box. Because if you have the box and you have your iPhone 1 handset and the serial numbers match, it's worth $2,000. I'm like, what? My iPhone 1 is worth more money than my iPhone 13 that I'm buying right now. And in fact, I'm such a geek about like saving boxes. I did have the original box from iPhone 1. I did. I had it. And all the bits and pieces, the little plastic bits and stuff, I had all that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm looking at it right now. It's in my trophy case. And I thought, wow, you know, obscure kind of, obsolete technology all of a sudden becomes a collector's item. Who would have thought, right?
Yeah, and such a short amount of time too. When you think about it, so tell
me, 2007 was when the iPhone 1 came out.
There you go, and I think that's when you started tweeting, right? 2007.
Yeah,
me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what are your thoughts as far as what can be done with this sort of state of social media. I know that's a huge topic. And
yeah, it's an enormous topic. I think the biggest problem is the algorithm. And I think the biggest problem is that Facebook is not stepping up to focus on the algorithm. Mm. And they've brainwashed everybody from their users to the media to members of Congress to believe that the problem is not their algorithm, but the problem is that people are posting things that are inappropriate and that their job is to then police that and take it down. And they talk about how they have thousands of people who are employed by Facebook to read content and then remove content that violates their term of service. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Sure, you can police the content and remove it.
Yeah.
But that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the algorithm. So I think until members of Congress and others recognize that the true problem is the algorithm and how people are being driven into these polarized ways, that this problem will continue. It will not go away. By selectively finding content to remove, it's a whack-a-mole. You're constantly finding more content you have to remove. It's a never-ending thing. But if you're able to change the algorithm so that you show people content in a different way than they do now, which is focused on polarization and getting people to be angry because that's what allows them to stay on the Facebook longer, that would make a big difference. And I think Facebook is by far the biggest problem, although all social networks have these kinds of algorithms. So Twitter and Instagram and whatnot all have them, but I think Facebook is the worst. And this was actually one of the things that prompted us, my daughter Reiko and I, to write Fanocracy because, you know, it was maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and I was talking to her and I said, you know, I'm known as somebody who has been a champion of social media. You know, I wrote about social media in my book, New Rules of Marketing PR, that came out in 2007. People know me as somebody who's been a cheerleader for social networks. And you know, I was on the various social networks pretty early and so on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I kind of feel like I've created and I'm not taking credit for it, but created a monster in a way. Mm-hmm. And I said, but at the same time, I'm such a fan of the things I love. I love to surf. I love the Apollo Lunar Program. I love the Grateful Dead. And she started to talk to me about the things that she loves, including K-pop, Korean pop music. Mm-hmm. She's also a big fan of Harry Potter. And we started talking about that. So we recognized, as we were having this discussion, I remember distinctly, we're in a car ride. We both kind of recognized that we had a different view of what marketing could be. And really, it was coming back to being human, coming back to the things that we love. And this is kind of cool how this happened, but I decided I wanted to write a book about fandom. And I started to do some research. I spent about 6 months doing research. I spoke with a bunch of people about what they're a fan of. I spoke with a bunch of companies that have developed a fan base. And I kept asking Reiko about, well, tell me about Harry Potter. Why do people love Harry Potter? Why is this so interesting? Tell me about Korean pop music, K-pop. Why is this so interesting? Tell me about Comic-Con. You know, she gets dressed up with her friends and goes to Comic-Con. And I totally dig it in terms of a fandom and a tribe of like-minded people. That's super cool. But I wouldn't want to get dressed up as my favorite character and go to a convention hall.
Sure.
And so she started to share with me her thoughts. And then I decided I was going to go to Comic-Con, which I did. I didn't get dressed up, but I went to Comic-Con. I interviewed some people. And then I finally said, don't be an idiot. Write the book with her. And she's a great writer. I already knew she was a good writer. And so I said, Reiko, this is stupid. Why do I keep asking all these questions? Why don't we write this thing together?
Yeah.
Which we did. So we did the remainder of the research, and then we wrote the book together. And I got to say, are your children boys, girls, one of each?
I've got a 16-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl.
Okay, so one of each.
Yeah.
So we've only got one. We've only got Reiko. But I was at a Tony Robbins event, speaking engagement. My wife was with me. And Reiko was in medical school at the time. No, she might have just graduated. But anyway, she was not with us. Mm. And so I opened up the Wall Street Journal because the book Fanocracy was coming out that week. And oh my gosh, we're on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. So I texted Reiko and I said, once you've had your tea this morning and you're sitting down, give me a call. And she called and I put it on speaker so my wife could hear. And I said, Reiko, you are a Wall Street Journal bestselling author. And then there's this like dead silence. And she's like, what? 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 I don't understand. That's crazy.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So that was just, I mean, and you would certainly recognize having two children that being able to make a call like that was super great. I actually forgot what your question was.
Oh, no. That's amazing.
More or less got an answer.
Yeah. No, I think that's fantastic. I mean, And by the way, my kids, I think she'd be a hero to my kids because they're, you know, especially my daughter, huge Harry Potter fan, huge nice. K-pop fan as well.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. Like I know the songs, like, because we listen to them in the car all the time. Yeah. And I never in a million years, I'm not really much of a pop music fan to begin with, let alone K-pop, which is obviously different. And so kind of learning all about that kind of world.
Really interesting. And so Reiko's become a bit of an expert in the fandom aspects of K-pop. And she actually did a couple of different virtual events where she spoke about the fandom aspects of K-pop. And she's got a really deep understanding about having written the book Fanocracy with me and having been a really big fan of K-pop. By the way, her favorite band is called the Stray Kids. I don't know if
it's the same one.
Is it?
Yeah, there's posters in her room right now.
They're a little bit obscure. BTS and some of the others are more Blackpink are more popular. But
right, I know them too. Yep.
Stray Kids is the one that Ray goes. Oh, that's so interesting.
Ella's all about Stray Kids, and it's
into
interesting.
The same thing.
But it's really weird too, because not to riff here for a second, but she She talks about how like there's like an organization that runs all these groups, and it's so, yes. And then like talking to me, and I'm much more into like old school, like kind of Americana folk, blues, punk rock, like that kind of music, and old school rock and roll kind of music. And so like anti-corporate stuff, and the Dead are like there. I mean, they personify an anti-corporate kind of thing. And then you've got these K-pop bands that are all like at least seemingly under like one parent company who like pull the strings like the Wizard of Oz or something. I don't really know. It's very strange.
And that's what Reiko dug into.
Yeah.
Big time dug into. And it turns out that in the very beginning when these bands come out, they're absolutely controlled by these companies.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Disney. Not exactly, but kind of like Disney, where these big companies hire beautiful looking actor types who can sing and dance. And then they write the music, and then they create these bands, and they pay all the expenses to have the albums produced and the videos produced and so on. But then if they start to take off and become popular, then the balance of power shifts to the band. Mm. And they have some ironclad contracts that go for a certain number of years. But then they can break free and they can do more interesting things. And it becomes a fascinating study in how much do you need those producers once you reach a certain level of fandom. And there's some that have broken out and done really well. There's some that have broken out and not done well because they needed that support structure to be able to do it right.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I guess it'll be an interesting kind of case study long term, because I think for the most part, this phenomenon is not that old. Like it's only like a decade, it seems anyway. So it would be interesting long term to see how that all kind of unravels.
And it's super interesting to me to look at. My friends all laugh at me, but I will admit I'm a Miley Cyrus fan.
Of course. She's talented, man. She's great.
She's super talented. So she came up through the Disney machine. Mm-hmm. And she was, she was Hannah Montana.
Yep.
And when she was part of the Disney machine, she would, she'd do concerts. And she was, young teenager type. But then when she left Hannah Montana, she became her own person and did a great job at not only keeping her initial fan base, but growing her fan base, even including someone like me, right?
Yeah.
And I had a chance to see Miley Cyrus backed by the Flaming Lips at a club in Boston. It was a small, 2,000-person club. It was fabulous. It was great. But that's an example of what that same sort of K-pop machine initially creates, something like Hannah Montana in Korea. And then if the artist is truly talented and savvy, they can then make it even more, just like Miley Cyrus has.
Yeah, they have the power of sort of the big labels did originally, before artists had mediums where they could, I don't know. I guess there's been plenty that have, used social and YouTube and the like to kind of become, what they are now. But it's an interesting, it's certainly an interesting time for music that way. It's fascinating. So as far as getting back to Fanocracy for a sec, a key point in the book also is, and to what we're talking about here is really bringing like-minded people together, as I mentioned before. And by doing this, you kind of instigate relationships and you become Absolutely. Sort of that centerpiece, because you're the one that's bringing people together, whether it's, giving a ticket to a new friend to a concert, or, I co-founded a couple networking events over the years and unconferences and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you a little bit, because it's kind of like the magic, probably. I haven't been to a Tony Robbins event, but I imagine it's like the magic that happens at these events. And Tony Robbins, of course, wrote the foreword for the book. And yes, in it, he writes about how you are a lead marketing speaker also at his Business Mastery Seminar. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about that backstory between you and Tony Robbins.
Super interesting. He started the Business Mastery program maybe 10 years ago, I'm guessing. And then he really wanted to have a marketing speaker. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was sort of auditioning marketing speakers. He would invite people to come and speak at Business Mastery, which typically is between 2 and 4 times a year. And he would invite people to come and speak. And then, so I got invited in 2014 to come and speak at Business Mastery. And, I didn't recognize that it was an audition, but I'm glad I didn't. Otherwise, I would have maybe freaked out a little bit. But I walked into a Tony Robbins event, and as I walked into the room, it was the day before I was to speak, because I always like to read the room, and I tend to like to arrive the day before if I can.
Yeah.
And if the conference is already going, I will go in the room and just get a sense of the vibe of the room. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen anything like a Tony Robbins event. The music is rock concert volume. They not only light the stage, but they light the audience. It's like the studio audience of a television show. You know, like imagine the Oprah show or something like that. They light the studio audience. And Tony makes sure that there's no more chairs than there are people. So that if there's 2,146 people in the conference, that's how many chairs there are. Because he always wants the room to feel intimate, even if it's an arena. And he sells out arenas, you know, 10,000, 12,000 people. So I walked into this room. It was in Las Vegas. And everyone is up and dancing and high-fiving and hugging. And I'm like, what in the world have I gotten myself into? Oh, my God. And so, but I'm really, really glad that I went the day before. And I just completely ripped up what I was going to speak on and changed it completely. I worked all night to change up the speech and did something very different and many things I had never done before in a speech. Like I did some push-ups on the stage. I jumped up and down like an idiot. I was like pointing at the audience, which I'd never really done before. So things that, you know, really was unique to my speaking that I hadn't done before. And I had a 2-hour slot. It's a long time to speak. I recognized you have to do a lot of things to make a 2-hour slot work.
Yeah.
I used music a lot, and so on. Tony told me, I met him backstage before I went on. He said, David, I'm really looking forward to seeing you speak. I can stay for about 5 minutes and I have to go. And I saw him on the riser, the production riser in the back of the room. I saw him sitting there. And then it was like 20 minutes later, he was still there. And then a half an hour later, he's standing up and his arms are in the air. And he stayed the entire time, 2 hours. Like, wow, that was cool. He said he was going to stay 5 minutes and he stayed for the whole 2 hours. And then they reached out to me and they booked me for 2 or 3 more events. And I've been speaking at Business Mastery ever since, 8 years now.
That's huge. That's amazing.
And it's been a really, really, really important relationship. Tony is fabulous. He helps people in so many different ways. He's got other programs too. He's got a program called Unleash the Power Within, UPW, that is very much focused on the entry level into Tony Robbins' world. And then there's the Business Mastery program that I do. And then there's something called Date with Destiny, which is more about relationships. He just has, talk about fans. He's got millions of fans. People love Tony Robbins. So I've learned a ton from him. I've become tight with a lot of people in the Tony Robbins world. And, you know, they all know I'm a Grateful Dead fan. They all know I'm a surfer. So I'm able to let my hair down about the things that I love. And it's been a really great experience for me to be a part of that community.
Yeah. And I mean, Tony Robbins is awesome. And I definitely enjoy the content and the documentary on, I believe it was on Netflix a while back.
Yeah. I am not your guru. It's called I Am Not Your Guru.
Yes.
It's worth watching if you haven't seen it. I Am Not Your Guru on Netflix. And you know, Tony, the producers of that movie have been after Tony for years to do a movie, and he kept saying no. And finally he agreed, okay, well, we can do it. And it does a great job at capturing what a Tony Robbins event is like and a little bit about what Tony Robbins, the man, is like. I think it was great that once he did agree, he gave the producers full and free rein. They could do whatever they wanted. He was not going to exert any editorial control. I give him a lot of credit for doing that because he didn't necessarily have to do that. And they ended up with a great film. It's done really well.
Yeah, no, I thought it was excellent too. And kudos to him for allowing them to have that kind of access. That's super cool. So I want to ask you a couple questions and then we'll move to lightning round and we'll wrap up right on time. So very quickly, how can companies build and sustain strong cultures in a remote and hybrid era where things are different now?
Tough one. I think the video is super important when it comes to making sure that you can focus not only on relationships with your colleagues, but also relationships with customers. And there's a neuroscience aspect to this. It turns out that video, if it's cropped as if you're right next to somebody, our human brain processes that through something called mirror neurons as if you're actually across the way from somebody. So imagine you're having dinner with somebody at a restaurant. That's a truly intimate relationship of having dinner with somebody at a restaurant. You're, you know, 3 or 4 feet away, very, very powerful from the human emotions perspective. Well, it turns out mirror neurons is a neuroscience concept that video gives you much of the same thing. And that's precisely why we feel we know a movie star or a television star. I mean, intellectually, you know, you've never met Tom Cruise, but you believe you know him because of your mirror neurons kicking in when you see him on the screen or on television, whatever it might be. And so using that in a hybrid world or a virtual world, super important, but not that many companies truly make good use of video. And let me give you one very specific example in the B2B world. So many people in the B2B world use sign-up forms. And, you know, you're, of course, experienced in this, as is anybody who does B2B marketing. You know, you have most companies have multiple sign-up forms. You know, fill out this form to get our white paper. Fill out this form if you want to have a conversation with a salesperson. Fill out this form if you want to have a free analysis of what you're doing, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out if you put a simple video next to that form and you say, you tell people exactly what's going to happen when they fill out that form, that can increase the number of people who fill out the form by between 20 and 50%. That's huge.
That is huge.
Between 20 and 50%. So if you want to see that in action, you can go to my website, davidmeermanscott.com, push the book me to speak button, and then you'll see there's a video right next to the form that I ask people to fill out. And what I say, and I'm paraphrasing now, but what I say in that video is, hey, thanks very much for visiting. I would love to talk with you about how I might present at one of your events. If you fill out the form, I'll personally get your form and I'll respond very, very quickly. We'll set up a quick call where I can learn a little bit more about what you're trying to do. So I'm basically saying to people, I'm not going to try to sell you. Don't worry about it. And that simple thing of humanizing that online signup form can generate between 20% and 50% more signups. And that's just because of the power of mirror neurons, the power of the idea that that people are, you know, they're human and they want to do business with other humans.
That is a great tip. And if you want to see that in action in a few days, maybe a week or so, drop by my website. I'm definitely going to try that.
It's really remarkable, Dave. Yeah. That, and I've shared this particular idea with dozens and dozens of companies, and the ones that implement it all tell me that they have a measurable increase in the number of people who sign up for the form.
Well, I'm one to act on advice I get from peers and people I respect and like. So I will definitely jump on that. All right,
So you'll see it in action on my site. You can see. I mean, there's other ways to implement it, but you'll see how I do it.
Yeah, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes so folks can just click the link in the in their iPhone or whatever they're using to listen. All right, let me move to lightning round and then I'll wrap up here because I know you got a hard stop. So some quick lightning round questions. So complete this sentence. Nice guys and gals finish.
Finish with much more fun than those who are not nice.
I love it. What's a nice book you recommend to the nice makers?
a nice book. I'm a big fan of anything Seth Godin does. So he's everything he writes has a human element to it, and I'm lucky to be able to count him as a friend as well. And so I can recommend anything that he writes.
Yeah, he still replies to my emails, which is always always amazing, a nice thing. Right? Yeah, Seth's, Seth's such a sweet, talented, great guy, and a Joni Mitchell fan, and I'm a big Neil Young fan, so we probably both canceled Spotify this week.
That's so funny. That's hysterical.
Yeah. It's been interesting. Okay, how is David nice to himself?
What's very, very important to me is every single day I exercise in the morning. And there's essentially, I don't have any excuses. I mean, there are some cases I have a very early morning flight. I don't exercise that morning. But I typically will do doubles the next day or the day before so that I exercise 365 times per year. Mm. And that's really important for me to be fit and healthy. It's really important for me to start out my day by moving my blood and doing something physical, especially right now. I live in the Boston area. It's cold as we're recording this. And being able to get out and move, even when I don't go out as much as I do in the summertime, super, super important to me.
Is that, how long have you been doing that? Like, is that something you've always done or something you picked up at some point?
It's been 11 years now. Mm. And I was getting, unhealthy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't obese, but I was overweight, and I went to my doctor and they ran some of the blood tests and said, you know what? You don't have hypertension. You don't have, diabetes. You don't have any of these things, but you're getting into the danger zone. Like, oh my God, this is something I can change. So I made a huge change in my lifestyle, and I started to eat differently, and I started this exercise program. And I'm a big believer in mixing up the way that I exercise. And there's nothing wrong with always doing one thing, like always running, nothing wrong with it. But I believe very strongly that doing different things is better. So someday I do weights, usually typically 2 days a week. I do yoga typically 2 days a week. I swim typically 2 days a week. But I also do mountain biking. I do surfing. I do Pilates. I like to hike in the woods, you know, like serious exercise style hiking up and down hills and stuff.
Yeah.
And those are some of the things that I love to do. And, about 12 years ago, I was 60 pounds heavier than I am now. And so it's really made a huge difference in my lifestyle.
Yeah.
But also it's not just that. I feel like, you know, the way you ask the question, I'm being nice to myself. It's something that's important for me. Sure, I could be answering more emails if I didn't do that, or I could be writing another blog post if I didn't do that, but that's super important for me.
Yeah. And it's so important at the end of the day. I mean, what's the point of everything we're doing if we just suddenly drop dead at a far too early age, God forbid, you know? I want to be around for my grandkids. So that's part of the reason doing it. Hopefully not too soon, but.
With a 16-year-old and a 15-year-old now, you want to wait a couple more years.
Yeah. Yes. And you wrote a blog post recently, by the way, that really resonated with me, which was, these are the good old days. And you wrote, something that stood out to me a lot, because I've been focused on my own mental health over the last couple of years with everything going on. And the fact that you said, you know, I'm focused on the moment. I know I can't change the past and I can't do much about the future besides some preparing. What I can change is what I do and how I feel right now in this moment. And I think mindfulness and meditation and just journaling and all that stuff, I think, is really beneficial.
I think that's super important. And something you mentioned earlier is also something that's very important to me right now, which is I'm always down for spending money on experiences, less so on spending money for things.
Yes.
However, I did spend a lot of money to buy a Grateful Dead stage used guitar, but that is because of the experience.
Yeah.
It's because I'm able to share that with musicians and fans. So those are some of the things I've been focused on recently is how I can have more experiences. And you know, one of the things I think about a lot is I feel like I'm entering the last third of my life. The first third of my life was what I call the education third of my life. So it was like formal education, you know, elementary school and middle school and high school and college, but also like learning a career, learning what marketing is and so on. The second half of my career was about building wealth and building experiences and building a family. The third part of my life is all about giving back. And I'm focused a lot on this idea of how I can give back, give my time, give my money, give my experience back in many different ways.
That's wonderful. And that's a great way to look at it. And I wish I'd had that. I wish I looked at my life that way much earlier on, but I'm glad I'm where I am now. And I'm, you know, I'm giving a percentage of my profit each quarter to different charities and causes I care about. Yes. And I'm working on is trying to increase that amount, that percentage that I'm giving away.
And, good for you.
And oh, it's a good way to keep me trying, like really full steam ahead at trying to grow my business, which, you know, is always a challenge, you know, solopreneur and all that stuff, but right. just growing my business because thinking about it this way, the better I do, the more I can serve the people and the causes I care about most. And so
I think about it exactly the same way. Yeah. It's super important. Exactly right.
You got to come to Nashville, man. I'm going to buy you dinner.
All right. I'm down for that.
I would love to see it. All right.
We covered a lot of ground in the last hour, Dave.
We sure did. Oh, I love talking to you. I've got one last question. If you had a billboard, sure. What would it say?
Educate and inform instead of interrupt and sell.
Heck yes. I'm 100% behind you there. I love it. All right, David, thank you so much. I sincerely appreciate your time. It's been a real
pleasure. My pleasure, Dave. Thanks a lot for having me on. Thanks for taking this discussion in many unusual directions. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to the NICE podcast. I would love to include your voice on the show. If you have comments or questions regarding this episode or any episode, whether you might have some NICE communications tips of your own, visit friend.nicepodcast.co. There, you can record an audio comment, and I expect you'll hear it on an upcoming episode. Theme song is Little Jane May, and the end song is Funny Feeling by Alistair Crystal at alistaircrystal.ca. And we'll see you next time. Be nice.